This Sunday we come to chapter 13. He now comes to the subject of our relationship to the state or government. And Paul's main point here in chapter 13 is that we should be in good standing with our governing authorities, whether you like them or not, whether they're your political persuasion or not. You should be in good standing with them. And I have 7 observations to make from this text. Number 1, every government is established by God. He says in verse 1, you can get it from your pew Bibles, NIV there. I'm reading from the ESV. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. So before I go on, I want to explain something really that I consider pretty fascinating about this one chapter and Paul's vocabulary. I don't like to go into the Greek just frivolously, but I want to tell you something today about the Greek words here. They're very interesting. There's a Greek word, a verb called tasso, T-A-S-S-O. Tasso means to establish or set something down or rank or put. And it's used here in 4 different ways. There's the word tasso, used of God. Then there's a word hippotasso, which is like what? Hippo is under, right? Hippopotamus, under the water. Hippotasso means to rank yourself under the authority. And then you have the word antitasso, which means to stand against authority. And so he tells us later on, don't do antitasso with your authorities. Don't take the stand of being always against your governing authorities, because they're established, they're tasso by God. Tassoed them, he ranked them, he put them there. It's our job to rank ourselves under them, and so don't be an anti-establishment person. And the last time he uses the word tasso is here, he says dia tasso. Dia means through, right? So dia tasso is God having beforehand established these people as the kings and the governors of the land. So dia tasso and tasso used of God, antitasso and hypotasso are used of man. Let every person be subject, hypotasso, to the governing authorities, to rank themselves under. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been ranked, they have been put there, established by God. Luke tells us that even Jesus continued to be subject. He uses the same word, hypotasso. Jesus hypotassoed his parents, his earthly parents, Mary and Joseph. Remember, he was 12 years old, and he wanted to go to the temple. He wanted to start his ministry, and Mary said, what are you doing? We've been looking for you for 3 days. He said, Mom, didn't you understand that I had to be in my father's business? And she said, no, I don't understand, basically. And so he came home and stayed with his parents another 18 years before he began his ministry. He submitted himself to them. It is the word used of wives to be subject to their husband, the same word. And of church members to be subject to their leaders, same word. And Paul even mentions it of employees to their employer, the slaves to be subject to their masters. So in every part of society, God expects us to find who we are to be ranked under, who we rank ourselves under, and honor them as our authority. This principle is also applied toward our governing authorities, be it the local police, or city council, state governor, the IRS, or the federal government. Daniel tells us this concerning the establishment of these authorities. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, Daniel chapter 2, to whom belong wisdom and might. Why? Because God changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and he sets up kings. He has complete authority to play out his script of history the way he wants to. And what's so fascinating about the book of Daniel is it shows several times that when God decides to remove a king from his throne, it's almost done in a supernatural way so that the entire world around it can witness that, oh my gosh, that happened only because God intervened. And Paul tells us in Acts 17 that God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries. Okay, so Paul's phrase, the periods of time and the boundaries, the geographic boundaries of their dwelling place, that's the same thing as Daniel saying he changes the times and the seasons. In other words, God in his sovereignty has allowed certain kings to come forward and to lead out a country or an empire, and then the time comes for that empire to be dismissed, and then another people come and take the forefront. This happens so often. This has happened so often in history that some historians have noticed it and said, wait a minute, what's going on here? How did it happen that this group of people that was just a province, like Rome, was just a province of the Persian Empire, and suddenly it becomes Rome, the empire, within a few years, within a few decades? How is it possible that after Alexander the Great, or I should say Persia, took over and started their empire of 120 provinces from India to the Mediterranean, then this little Macedonia state and a little guy named Alexander, in a few years, he took over the world, and all the way from India to the Mediterranean. And then everyone spoke Greek for several hundred years, and then that's why the New Testament's in Greek, Becky, because of Alexander the Great being allowed by God to create an empire that everyone learned the same language. And after that, even the Romans could not supplant Greek out of the people, right? They didn't. They might have said, well, we're going to have signs in Latin, but they could not undo the miraculous power of Greek and how Greek had taken over the Mediterranean nations and all the way, you know, into the farther east. And so God gave us our New Testament in Greek because everyone could understand it. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth because God determined their allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. So I had heard about this book maybe years ago, and I finally found it this last week, and I want to read you some passages from here. I'd like to illustrate this truth that God has established every human government, and let me read to you from the book The Fate of Empires and the Search for Survival by Sir John Glubb. Anyone heard about this before, The Fate of Empires? No one, okay? This is new to you. He was a British military leader in the Middle East from he was born in 1897, and his main time was in until about 1950, I think, so maybe like 1920 to 1950, he was in the Middle East. So he learned the Arabic, but anyway, one of his hobbies was to study history, and Sir Glubb, he observed that throughout history, that every great empire lasted about the same amount of time. And then another people conquered that region and reigned in place. So his observations and conclusions are fascinating. This is what I'm quoting him now. In a surprising manner, 250 years emerges as the average length of national greatness. This average has not varied for 3,000 years. Does it represent 10 generations? He thinks maybe it's 25 times 10 because it keeps dying. The nation would be born, the empire hits a zenith, and then it comes down and finally dies, and then someone else takes over. Another empire takes over. And then he actually listed the stages of an empire, just like the body of a human being. You are born, you grow into a child, you know, into puberty, then you have young adulthood, and then you reach your middle age, and then you finally get older, and then you die. In the same way, empires do the same thing. They have a line of existence that's very similar to the human being. The stages of rise and fall of great nations seems to be this. Number one, the age of pioneers, or the outburst, when they first come on the scene and they take over. The age of conquest, when they take over one country after another and they become the empire. Instead of just a little country, then they become an empire. Then comes the age of commerce. And then the age of affluence, when they're the wealthiest of all the nations on the earth. Then comes the age of intellect. And finally, you have the age of decadence. And Glubb says this, the decadence age is marked by a nation who becomes defensiveness, pessimism, materialism, frivolity, an influx of foreigners, the welfare state, and a weakening of religion. Incredible, David. Yeah. I'll send the article to you. It's just amazing. He says, decadence is due to these things. Too long a period of wealth and power. Selfishness. Love of money. And the loss of a sense of duty. That's when you know your empire's in trouble. By the way, America reaches 250 years in 2026. We have 6 more years. He said the high noon, if you look back at the time of the Persians or the time of the Babylonians or the time of Macedonia, of Alexander the Great's empire or the Roman Empire, it doesn't matter which one you choose, or the British Empire or America, he says, you'll have this time of what I call high noon when they reach their apex, their zenith. So the age of the high noon is that which we may call the high noon is a nation that covers the period of transition from the age of conquest to the age of affluence, right in the middle there. That's when they reach their zenith. So, the age of Augustus in Rome, and that of Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad, of Suleiman the Magnificent in the Ottoman Empire, or of Queen Victoria in Britain. And perhaps we might add the age of Woodrow Wilson in the United States, about 19, during World War I after that. All these periods reveal the same characteristics. The immense wealth accumulated in the nation, it dazzles the onlookers. Enough of the ancient virtues of courage and energy and patriotism survive to enable the state to successfully to defend its territories, its frontiers. But beneath the surface, the greed for money is gradually replacing duty and public service. Indeed, the change might be summarized as being from service to selfishness. I'm not quoting Billy Graham here. I'm quoting this man, Sir Glubb. Whatever causes may be given for the overthrow of great civilizations by barbarians, we can sense certain resulting benefits. Every race on earth has distinctive characteristics. Some have been distinguished in philosophy, some in administration, some peoples are in romance, some poetry or religion, or some in their legal system. So during the preeminence of every culture, its distinctive characteristics are carried by it far and wide across the world. If the same nation were to retain its domination indefinitely, then its peculiar qualities would permanently characterize the whole human race. But under the system of empires, which each last 250 years, the sovereign race has time to spread its particular virtues far and wide. And then, however, another people with entirely different peculiarities, could be China next, right, take its place, and its virtues and accomplishments are likewise disseminated. So get ready, in my lifetime, in our lifetime, we might see this switch happen, right? By this system, each of the innumerable races of the world enjoys a period of greatness during which its peculiar qualities are placed at the service of mankind. And to those who believe in the existence of God as the ruler and director of human affairs, such a system may appear as a manifestation of divine wisdom. Now, he would say it was divine wisdom because it tends toward the slow and ultimate perfection of humanity. But I'll tell you what, Paul said the opposite. Paul said, no, he makes a different conclusion. That they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. The purpose of it is not to get us all perfect through these different people, empires that take over the world. Rather, the purpose is to show this, according to Paul, that no human government has ever lasted 1,000 years and cannot take us into the future. No, not one of them. Every one of them has its rise and then its fall. And then another one comes in, rise and falls. Every last human government that was ever established, an empire. Why? Because Paul said, so that people would seek after God. His son is the one who will establish a kingdom that will last forever. Finally, we'll have a perfect king. Finally, we'll have a law to reign over our hearts that keeps us from the things that happen typically in these other empires. And that is happening right in our own America. And has been for 50 years. Number two, we should not resist those in our authority. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. This is the antitasso word. Don't set yourself against the established authorities. Don't arrange yourself in battle against them. Don't oppose them. What God has appointed is diataj, which comes from diataso, means thoroughly set in place by the Lord, by his perfect appointing and arranging. Now, this is hard to imagine because at the time that Paul wrote this, Nero was the emperor. So how could Paul say this, Dick, about an emperor that was so ungodly like Nero? And later on, Nero became really bad after the fire of Rome, and then he began putting Christians to death, using them as torches at night in his palace. But Paul said there's no reason to resist our authorities. They were put there by God. Even a terrible person is still put there. And we can honor the position, even if we don't like the character. We can still submit to the person and show respect, even though we disagree with what they're doing. Number three, rulers are appointed to punish evildoers and approve of good citizens. Verse three, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who's in authority? Then do what is good and you'll receive his approval. Notice how similar these words of Paul are to those of Peter. Peter also spoke about this in 1 Peter 2:13-17. Thank you, Wade, for the suggestion. Peter says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. So honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. And he concludes with, honor the emperor. This was a godless man. This is not a Christian man. There was not the first Christian emperor in Rome was Constantine. That was 250 years later. But they're saying, no, honor the king who is there right now because God put him there. This principle is true whether the ruler is God-fearing or not. We see this principle illustrated in Paul's life when he stood before Governor Felix and Festus and Agrippa. All these men, they were worldly men. They lived as unredeemed men. They were proud. They were corrupt. They were immoral kings and governors who didn't give much thought about God until they came into contact with Paul. But notice how Paul treated them with such respect. With Governor Felix, Luke tells us that he said, when the Governor Felix had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, knowing that for many years you have been the judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. That was his words to a man who was corrupt. He wanted a bribe from Paul. This is the same man, and yet he treated him with respect. With King Agrippa, you know, King Agrippa shows up with Bernice. When I was younger, I thought that was his wife, and then I realized, oh my gosh, not until recently did I realize Bernice is his sister. And there was a rumor going around that they were committing incest because his sister, when she was married to someone else, they divorced and she came back to live with her brother. Some people say it was not anything sexual there, but it was a rumor that was spreading all over that people wondered about it. And Paul must have known about it. And yet Paul treats this man with great respect. So Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. Paul stretched out his hand to make his defense and said, I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I'm going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, because, especially, you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. So I beg you, therefore, to listen to me patiently. Every single authority that Paul has put before, he respects them. And we can imagine when he got to Nero, he respected him as well, the emperor. So you might ask the question, what happens if we have a wicked ruler or someone who persecutes Christians? Are we still to be subject to them? And the answer is this. Whenever a ruler or authority asks you to do something wrong against Scripture, then that's when you obey God rather than man. But you can still do that respectfully. This is what Peter said before the Sanhedrin, right? Whether it is right, they commanded Peter, do not speak again in the name of Jesus. Stop it. And he said, well, whether it is right before God to obey you or God, then you can be the judge, but we're not going to stop speaking of that which we have seen and heard. This is also the basis for nonviolent civil disobedience that Martin Luther King stood for. Same principle. When there's a law like the Jim Crow laws that we're treating a group of humans as subhumans, then that law has to change. And that's right then to take civil disobedience. The whole point of the civil disobedience was to do it peacefully, right? There was no violence. He eschewed violence from the beginning. He said, no one that is part of our team here is going to commit any act of violence against the white man. No one. They are our brother. And all we will do is stand for what is right. And we will disobey only that which is wrong in these laws. Like being forced to sit in the back of the bus. Or go to the colored bathroom instead of the white bathroom. And things like that. And because of that, he gained the respect of many white people and the whole nation and even the whole world. You know, there are more stamps with a picture of Martin Luther King in other countries, in Africa and Europe and stuff like that, than any other, I think, American leader. The stamps. They actually put a stamp out, like from Somalia, from wherever, Nigeria. And there is Martin Luther King. He didn't even live there. But he had such an impact. He was such a respected man because he stood for what was right. He learned that if you stand for what is right, you can oppose what is wrong in the government without denigrating the government, without committing revolution, without taking up arms. Number four, capital punishment is a biblical principle. Paul says, for he, that is the governor or the king, is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, then be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. This is not a sword of a symbolic sword, like a nice, beautiful, you know, a flashy sword that a guard might have on his entourage or whatever. This is a real sword, a sword that you can kill people with, a sword that you can decapitate people with. This is a sword that was used to kill a criminal, to execute a criminal. And Paul says he does not bear the sword in vain. So Paul is saying, don't mess with the government. If you lose your life for having done something wrong, then you deserve it. Because God, he goes on to say, he is a servant of God. That's the word deacon, the same word, deacon. He's a deacon of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Now, I know in California, the governor just passed something that says no more death penalty. But I'm telling you, that's not a scriptural notion. The scripture way back in the book of Genesis, before there was even any Israel, right? This is before Jacob, this is before Abraham, this is before the patriarchs, this is back to Noah's time. At the time of Noah, after the flood, God instituted capital punishment. Because as you might remember, Genesis 6 begins with the phrase, the whole earth was filled with violence. You know, it started out with Cain killing his own brother Abel. And then you have, seven generations later, you have Lamech, this man who, for the first time in history, a man took two women. One wasn't enough. He wanted to have two wives. Polygamy started way back early. And then he kills this young man because he offended him somehow. And he said, oh, I got angry with him. I killed him. Oh, and then he made fun of the whole thing and said, well, if Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech will be avenged 77 times. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The attitude of Lamech and then what followed after him. Finally, the world became so violent because there was no capital punishment. There was no one to stop the criminals. Anyone who wanted to act that way could act that way. Anyone who wanted to kill could kill and get away with it. And so God tells Noah, for your lifeblood, I'll require a reckoning. From every beast, I'll require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? Because God made man in his own image. He's talking about the victim here, right? He's saying the reason you have to enact capital punishment is because what they did was so heinous. This person was made in my image and he destroyed their life. That is a serious thing that he has to forfeit his life for that. And whenever I've dealt with the pros and cons of the death penalty, and whenever I read it, the people that are against the death penalty, I feel like, you know what? The one person you're always not talking about is the victim. You're always talking about the accused or the perpetrator, that we can't have the state kill him and stuff like that. But you're not taking into consideration the needs of that victim. That wife just lost her husband. Those children just lost a dad because this man murdered him. And you're going to let him go for 25 years in jail and then let him out? Is that really doing justice for the victim? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And furthermore, what's interesting is that Moses knew that that was a serious thing. Capital punishment is a very serious punishment. And he would not allow people to utilize it without having safeguards in it. So even Moses, in his own law in Deuteronomy, he put in a safeguard to make sure that this was not done frivolously or without investigation and without enough witnesses. So watch what Moses says. A single witness may not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he's committed. So if someone came to the leaders of the village or the city or the town, you know, wherever they were in Israel, and say, hey, so-and-so killed my husband or my, you know, whatever. Well, did anyone else see it? Well, no, but I know because I was there. Well, I'm sorry, but that we need at least two, but preferably three witnesses. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. And then watch this. This is most fascinating. Moses says, if, however, a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, in other words, someone that does it wrongfully, that's not true, but he's accusing him, to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in the office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness who has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he has meant to do to his brother. Can you imagine that? So you shall purge the evil from your midst. So Moses took very seriously a false accusation. A false accusation was a very, very serious crime. And the punishment for that person, if it found out, would be the same punishment that they wanted their enemy, their person to, to suffer. Now, this idea of capital punishment, some people say, well, in the New Testament, you don't see it anymore. It changed. Once the age of grace started, then we forgive people. We don't commit capital punishment anymore. But if you look at what Paul says before Festus, he says this. Festus, if then I am a wrongdoer, if I have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. The assumption with Paul, from Paul, Dick, is that capital punishment, the right of Rome to execute a criminal was a God-given right. And he did not seek to get away. He said, if I've done something that deserves death, I do not seek to get away from it. You kill me. You go ahead and execute me, because that's your right. You bear the sword, not in vain. God gave you that sword for a purpose. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. So I appeal to Caesar. Bruce Fine, the JD, General Counsel for the Center of Law and Accountability, he wrote this about capital punishment. Those who want to abolish capital punishment, they might contend that the death penalty is inherently immoral because governments should never take human life, no matter what the provocation. But that's just an article of faith, not a fact. The death penalty honors human dignity by treating the defendant as a free moral actor, able to control his own destiny for good or for ill. It does not treat him as an animal with no moral sense. Moreover, capital punishment celebrates the dignity of humans whose lives were ended by the perpetrator. Verse 5, therefore one must be in subjection not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. Well, someone might say, but I thought we were supposed to forgive those who do us wrong. Why does Paul now mention the idea that leaders are servants of God and an avenger who carries out God's wrath? The verse before, chapter 13, is leave room for the wrath of God, right? Do not take vengeance, my brothers. So how do we work with those two things? Here he's saying they carry the sword. They're actually a servant of God, and they're commissioned by God to take vengeance. They're a servant of God's wrath. And here he's saying, don't take vengeance. Let me illustrate it with a triangle. Imagine here a triangle before you. Up above is the authority. Here you are, and here's the perpetrator. The perpetrator does something. The criminal does something against you. They steal your thing, or you're burned down your house, or they steal your car. And Paul's, according to Romans 12, you are not to go back and take vengeance. You are not to go back and say, well, since you did that, I'm going to find something in your house. I'm going to burn your house down or whatever. That is chaos. That's how you have a crime-infested neighborhood, right? By people taking vengeance. Here's the triangle again. The person, the perpetrator hurts you. You're the victim. What do? You go to the judge. You go to the one in authority and say, this happened to me. Would you please see that justice is done? And the authority is the one appointed by God to execute the punishment on the criminal, not you. One time, my daughter Bethany came home from school. She was in first grade or second grade in Germany. And she came home crying and just totally distraught. I said, what happened, sweetheart? What did you do? Why are you so upset? She said, Daddy, these three boys in the class, they came out, and I was walking, and they took they have these little backpacks that are the book bags, but they have little straps, you know. And they took her by the backpack, and they pulled her down, and she fell down on the ground, and I don't know what else they did, but they didn't harm her much more, but they pulled her down, so she fell on the ground with her book bag, and she felt terrible because these boys were being so mean to her. And I said, Bethany, let's pray together, and tomorrow we'll go to the teacher and tell her what happened. So the next morning, and I think I explained this principle, how we go to the authority, we ask them to take the punishment that the boys deserve. So we went to the teacher and we said, look, such and such happened. These three boys from the other class went and harmed my daughter, and they did this. And so the teacher said right then, it was maybe 10 o'clock in the morning, she said, Bethany, I want you to come with me right now. And so they went down the hallway, and she opened the door and said, now. And she asked permission from the other teacher, said, I need 1 minute to identify some people. She said, fine. So she said, Bethany, who are they? And she walked up to them and said, him, him, and him. And so she said, thank you very much. And she went back in the class, and then I went home. So then she came home later on and said, Daddy, you won't believe what happened. Oh, well, what happened, Bethany? Well, after school was over, the three boys came over to me, and they all apologized. And they said they would never do it again. It was such a special moment for her to know that God had provided an authority to be her defense when needed. And to know that you don't try to take that. It wasn't my job to take action against the boys. It wasn't her job to try to do it. She couldn't do it anyway. She was helpless, right? But it was the teacher, the one in authority, who could come to her defense and tell those boys, I don't know what else, it was the other teacher, the teacher of the boys, that really threatened my son. I think that if they ever do it again, they would, you know, she would do something very, very severe. But anyway, that's the illustration that I'm trying to say. That's the point here. That God has set up our authority, the judge, the police, the governor, the president, so forth. These are the authorities commissioned by God to enact punishment. And if they don't punish, then you have chaos. You have a land that is without any control, right? Because any criminal gets away with whatever they do. That's why it's so important that Paul says God put these authorities for our benefit. So as far as we are the recipients of the crime, we are to forgive the criminal, but those in authority are charged with punishing the criminal in God's stead. Number five, government leaders are God's servants. For verse 6, because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. The reason that uses the word minister here is because that's the same word used of priests in the Old Testament. The Levitical priests are called this same word, ministers. In other words, they're public servants or priests. They're the ones standing between the authority of God and the people, like a priest does. And they attend themselves. That attending means devoting themselves continually to. That's their job, to make sure that we have public, the peace of the public. Notice how God describes his relationship with Cyrus the Persian emperor. Oh, you know what? I forgot. How many minutes am I? I must be near the end. I forgot my little timer here. Sorry. So if I go over 40 minutes, you know it's because Chris's early dementia. Let's see. I'll just say that you can look at Isaiah 45 and see what he says about Cyrus, but God tells Cyrus, before he even came, that God appointed him to be the leader of the empire so that his people could come back home. So for number six, I'll go and race through the rest. We should pay our taxes without complaining. You probably say, oh, why don't you skip that one? No, we have to talk. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom, Alan, Fernando, that's you too. Okay. Taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue, respect to whom respect is owed, and honor to whom honor. And the word to pay is apodote, which means to pay back, right? We already owe it to them, and we have to pay it. We have to repay it every time. And I always get kind of upset, but, my CPA is Vera Katz. She's a wonderful CPA, and she set it up so that the government would automatically draw from my bank account, take the money that for that quarter that I need to get out. And I'm always surprised by it. It's like, what? $800? Oh, that's right, the IRS. The IRS. Bless the Lord for the IRS. Every four 3 months, they take out $800 from you because that's their right. Number seven, we should be debt-free and free to love others. Oh, let me just say this. That some of you guys here, some people like to work for cash, and I'm telling you, if you work for cash, then try to get out of it and pay your taxes. Because if we're working for cash, we're denying the government. We're taking the benefits of the government, right? The government gives us all kinds of benefits, but we're not paying into it what we should. And Paul, Jesus, both of them, and Peter, every one of them talks about paying taxes. It's one of those painful things that must be done because the government is also commissioned by God. It would be like saying in the church, well, we have, four elders, but we're not going to pay anything. We're not going to give anything here. Well, how do you maintain a ministry if you don't have some kind of income? Some kind of pay. So just as we pay a tithe to the Lord and to help supply the needs of the leaders of the church and so forth, so we pay a tithe or so, or sometimes that's more than 10%, right? Sometimes it's like 30% to the government so that we can pay for our services that they give us too. So I just encourage you, if you're working for cash, then tell your boss or tell them, hey, please turn in whatever, 1099, or start doing this because I want to pay my taxes to the government. Because what you're doing is you're saying to God, ultimately, God, I trust you that you will, after I pay my taxes and after I pay my tithe, you'll supply enough for me to take over. And I'll tell you that, Kathy, this last week, I just dropped my income by $650, right? Because I said, Wade, you take 5 hours a month, 5 hours a week, and now I'm going to be dropped down to 15 hours a week. So I just realized, wait a minute, that's $650 a month. What am I going to do with making up for that difference? And I just realized, I just have to live with it. God will help me. He'll help me make the adjustments. And when it comes to 20 hours, it's even a lot less for me. The Lord will help me. And one of the ways he helped me was last week, my sister texted me a message saying from Seattle. She said, Chris, I just got a bonus from last year, but we just got it this week. And I wanted to share some of the bonus with you. I want you to take Mom and Tiffany and Karen and take them on a little vacation. So I was expecting a couple hundred dollars. A lot more came in. I'm like, Karen? What are you doing with this much? No, 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 I want you to go. Okay, okay, okay. No, I'm not going to argue. So we had this little cabin that we rented out in Idlewild, and we'll be there in the middle of this March with a vacation that I haven't taken in I don't know how long. So thank the Lord that on the 1 month that I got less, he gave me more, because he can provide us with whatever. He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. He can provide for whatever our needs are. But I encourage you to pay your taxes. At least you have a clear conscience then. In fact, he concludes with saying, owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. So owe no one. Don't be in debt all the time. Don't be in debt to people. Don't be in debt to the bank. I got this from discover.com. This is how we conclude today. Here are 6 habits that anyone can apply to their financial life to help them stay debt-free. Number 1, manage your credit card balances and pay on cash on hand. So, like, I have a credit card. I think my limit is $333,000. And they always say, well, what's your income, sir? And I say, zero. Because I know what they're going to do. If I tell them my income, they're going to give me a credit limit of $9,000 or something. I don't want that much credit. I don't want that much. So I just leave it at $3,000, and every 2 weeks I pay it up. Pay it down to zero. I don't want to pay one penny interest to the bank. And thankfully, at the end of the year, I get 2% back, right? Yeah, you go ahead, cough it up. Give me that 2%. I was at Costco, and I said, can I have my money now? And they said, yes, $600. There you go. Thank you very much. It's still on my desk. Just sits there. I think that's how I want it to be. The bank will pay me, not me them. Manage your credit card balances. Pay on cash. You know, pay cash right as soon as you spend it. Monitor spending with self-imposed credit limit, like I just mentioned. Limit your housing expenses. If you can, try to find the cheapest solution. Right? Matt and Debbie have a really small little place, but it's perfect. And if they spent more rent, it would wipe out all the rest of their income. And I too, Karen and I rent one little room for $800, and Mom rents her room, and that's how we keep our expenses low, by keeping the housing expenses low. Limit housing expenses. Pay yourself first. In other words, put money into your savings. My wife has put in $500 every month. Every month, $500 goes. And now she has, oh my gosh, she has so much money. I'm thinking, how did you do this in 10 years' time? Well, she has saved quite a bundle. As for our retirement, of course, we need it. But still, I'm very proud of Karen for the discipline of putting away every month. Before she sees any of it, it's gone into the savings. Number 4, make it your mission to avoid unnecessary fees. Number 5, don't give your budget a raise. Thank you, Fernandos. We got that lesson from them, right? The Fernandos were $26,000 in debt, credit card debt, and they said, that's it. He got a full-time job. He says, we're going to pay this off, and we're going to live the same. So they lived the same, on the same amount of money they had been living for a couple years when things were really rough, and they didn't increase that, and they paid off all their debts within a year. They were down to zero because they were able to not give their budget a raise until finally they were, you know, doing better. So that's from discover.com. All right. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry if I went over. I have no idea what my time was today because I forgot my little phone. Next time I'll do it.